We start the final day of our board meeting. Michael, I give the floor to you.
Thank you. Yes, good morning, everybody. Start with agenda paper 12, which is the IFRIC update from the September meeting of the Interpretations Committee. There were four items that I just wanted to highlight for you this morning. First of all is the item starting on page two of the IFRIC update, and that is an issue that the committee has started to look at relating to the interaction of IAS 28 and IFRS 9, and in particular the impairment of long-term interests. IAS 28 requires that when you've got interests in an associate, such as a long-term loan, which are viewed as being part of that long-term interest, that you should allocate share of losses to that, and that you should consider that for impairment in accordance with IAS 36. What the Interpretations Committee is looking at there is how that interacts with IFRS 9, and in particular, two things. One is the impairment side, so do the IFRS 9 impairment requirements additionally apply? And also, how does the amortized cost calculation operate for those sorts of interests where you've got an item which is principally payments of principal and interest? That's which they're looking at, and they'll continue to look at the next meeting. They felt that it isn't clear at the moment, and that some form of clarification would be needed for that.
Francis, can we?
Yeah, can I?
Is purely related to 9, you know, by the end. You know, my question is, should we, you know, transfer the issue to the transitional group, or should we wait? Because we have a problem related to revenue.
Shall I give you my take on it, if I may? I mean, this question isn't about the application of the impairment model in IFRS 9. And my understanding of the impairment transition group is that that's what that is focused on. This is about sort of around the impairment model rather than the impairment model itself.
Much more 28 than 9.
Indeed.
Yeah, maybe I could add to that. I'd agree with what Michael said, because we're trying to restrict the impairment discussions to the application of an expected loss model, which isn't the question here. But I think the other important thing is that this hasn't been caused by 9. No. I think there's always been a question about how the interaction between IAS 28 and IAS 39 worked before in terms of the impairment models. I think because IFRS 9's moved from an incurred loss to an expected loss model, it's made the question more acute. Mm-hmm. But the actual interaction question hasn't changed.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. The second item I wanted to highlight is the item on page 4 relating to IAS 16 and IAS 38. This is an issue where we're looking at variable payments for the purchase of assets, and whether and when a liability should be recognised for that purchase commitment, when there's variable payments, and when there are changes in that liability, how those should be reflected, should they be made against the asset, the cost of the asset, or recognised in profit or loss. It's an issue that we've brought to you before, because the committee did look at this some time ago, and it was decided that it should be put on hold until the leases project had been substantially concluded. Given that that is the case now, the committee started to look at this in September. We initially brought to them an analysis of what the accounting would look like if the leases guidance was to be applied in those circumstances. They've asked us to do some more follow-up work to that, in particular looking at and explain to them the conceptual basis for the decisions in the leases project, so that they can consider those in the light of these types of transactions, which are different. They are purchases of assets rather than leases. So we'll be continuing with that next time. It is obviously quite a significant issue, and so I do expect that we'll be bringing some sort of paper back to you at some stage once the committee has made some progress in its considerations on this.
Ask again, is there any relation with the revenue standards? Because, you know, the recently the revenue standards side also faced problems, you know, about variable payment.
That's right, and certainly we are going to be just touching on that at the next committee meeting, looking at what we've got there in terms of on the revenue side. The revenue side would potentially be the other side of the transaction.
Yeah.
So not always, but sometimes. So we will sort of consider what IFRS 15 would have to say about that and what we might learn from that as well. The next item to highlight is on page 7, and we've got a number of tentative agenda decisions that the committee has published for comment that we'll be looking at again in the January meeting at the comments that we receive on those. But I just wanted to highlight, we had spoken to you, discussed with you in July, a number of IFRS 5 related issues, and we had spoke to you about the fact that we thought some of these would be appropriate for looking at through agenda decisions. There are two in particular. The first two that are on page 5 are items where the committee feels there is sufficient guidance on these issues and so has published its conclusions in the tentative agenda decisions. The third one, which starts on page 8, is really sort of catching all of the other issues they've been looking at over recent months and just effectively parking those pending the outcome of the agenda consultation. Obviously, you referenced the IFRS 5 issues in the agenda consultation, so the committee wants to wait and see what happens with regards to the feedback received on that. And then finally,
I'm not sure whether this is related to this part, but I've heard at the IFRS conference in Hong Kong, some people has suggested us to make our amendments, in even in narrow scope amendments. They would like to see these amendments as a kind of a once in a year, maybe, mm-hmm. in a package, because those practitioners are having difficulty in following every issue of narrow scope amendment. So if we can do or provide such a service in a package once a year, like annual improvements once in 2 years, then those practitioners will be very happy, because many people have suggested such kind of improvements in our this kind of responses.
I thought we were trying to do that already where that made sense. So, for example, when we were looking at changes a while ago to IFRS 13, I know we held some back to try and look at a cluster of things together.
Yes.
So maybe people just don't realise that we're doing it and we should be more vocal about it.
Yeah, and there's maybe two things. One is sort of clustering things together so that when they're related to one another, putting those out as one exposure draft or amendment. The other is that we only have amendments starting now on the 1st of January, for effective years from the 1st of January, in order to sort of effectively group that together as well, so that we don't have different effective dates during the course of the year as well. But it is a concern that I've also heard.
I think grouping the actual publication date is also helpful. I get the point on effective dates, but I think grouping them on an actual publication date is helpful for people who follow this stuff.
And I thought we were trying to do that.
Yes.
We've already done that. But we can always do better.
We can do more.
Yeah.
Maybe we should, at some point in the administration or maybe in a public meeting, just go back and have a look at how we proceeded in the recent past on publication so that we can give some evidence to the public that we have made improvements in managing the flow of products.
Okay, and then finally, I wanted to just highlight on page 11 related to the ISB's agenda consultation. You may recall that back in the last agenda consultation, the Interpretations Committee responded to the consultation and wrote a letter to the board. They discussed at the September meeting whether they should do the same again this time, and concluded that on the one hand, they feel that there is good regular communication between the committee and the board, so you are familiar with the issues that they are dealing with, so there isn't the need to highlight specific issues necessarily to you through the consultation, but perhaps they could relay to you their views on prioritisation of issues that you're consulting on. So they're going to continue that discussion at the November meeting in likelihood send a letter through to you for consideration as part of the consultation feedback. Mary.
Michael, a couple of questions. One on one you commented on, one that you hadn't. The one that you commented on is that one about the variable payments by operator of the service concession. It may just be reading the summary rather than the underlying papers, but it seems like there's some discussion about the operator already has a right to operate, makes additional variable payments, and looking at whether or not those should be recognized as an additional asset. And I just wanted to put up a warning flag because this notion of incremental cost relating to an intangible asset, at least, is something that we're also wrestling with, had considered in rate regulated and elsewhere, and I think see a lot of problems associated with additional payments adjusting the carrying value of intangibles when there isn't an increase in the capacity, duration, et cetera, of the intangible. And just wanted to flag up that we look at that cautiously because it would be difficult, I think, if the interpretation committee went one way and it was out of sync with the board's consideration in other projects. And then the other one is back on page 3, the IS 16 PP&E, and in part, I think some of the additional work that the committee has asked the staff to do about allocating costs, et cetera. It's starting to feel like this is becoming the beachhead for an extractive industries project, and I want to rely on in the interpretation committee's judgment about what is critical in practice today and areas where guidance is needed. But I think it's worth standing back and saying, are we in essence doing an extractive industries bit by bit by bit in terms of the issues? I think in the end that wouldn't be good for either the board or the industry in terms of a state of perpetual change, and maybe just at some point stand back and look at what else is in the pipeline on that one.
Thank you.
Okay.
I think I can move to
yes, I think so. Yeah. So we go to 12A?
Yeah. Okay. Okay, good morning, everyone. I turn your attention to paper 12A now, which is to deal with borrowing cost. The interpretation committee received a request to clarify the calculation of the capitalization rate on general borrowing that should be applied to certain qualifying assets. In particular, the scenario, the submission was that scenario where funds were obtained to finance the construction of a specific qualifying asset. The construction has now been completed, the funds have not been repaid as yet, and the entity have other assets that have been funded from the general borrowing pool that are eligible for interest capitalization. So the question was whether that specific borrowing, which was initially borrowed for that specific asset, should now be transferred to the general borrowing pool and included in the whole pool for determining the capitalization rate. The committee looked at this issue and discussed it in their meetings in May and July, and they looked at the wording in paragraph 14, and on the basis of that wording, they thought that the specific borrowing should be included in the general borrowing pool. But they also noted that the wording makes reference to it. It says you should include in the capitalization rate all borrowing other than those made specifically to obtain a qualifying asset. And they noted that this could be seen as making a reference to the historical purpose of the borrowing, which could also provide a basis for not including that particular borrowing in the general borrowing pool. So they felt that an amendment was needed to this paragraph. So I'll just pause there for a minute and ask my first question as to whether the board agrees with the analysis of the interpretations committee that the specific borrowing should be transferred to the general borrowing pool.
I must remind that I dissented to the original IS-23 amendment, which required capitalization of borrowing costs, and I'm no longer, I'm still not a fan of the idea of capitalizing such an expense. I don't see any benefits. But this being said, this is a standard as it is today, and this is just a clarification, so I'm not going to dissent. But I think it's not very good accounting, especially when you have initial back-to-back asset on financing. Okay, let's be it, capitalized. But we have excess financing just to reallocate this excess financing to other undefined projects at the moment is, I think, just a kind of smoothing. It's just a smoothing mechanism. You amortize, actually, interest expense over years, and so it's not good accounting.
Here, here. Darryl.
I agree with the analysis that the wording creates a little bit of uncertainty in terms of the way you do it. I did find it quite hard to think that if I had borrowed money specifically for the purposes of constructing an asset and I haven't repaid the funding and I still have the asset, it feels to me like the purpose of that funding is still to fund the asset. And so I to me there was almost a second question that was missing here, which is, do I still have the asset? And if so, I think that funding still attaches to it. If I don't have the asset, it doesn't. That said, I'm not, I'm probably in Philippe's point in saying that this doesn't feel like a particularly effective way to do it, and I don't really mind where we come out. I think we do need to fix the wording. Good. But to say, my inclination would be to say, if the asset still exists, then the borrowing seems to attach to that asset.
I don't just quite follow that yet. So, you know, normally when you borrow to build an asset, you don't repay. I mean,
precisely.
It takes a while. So that's a normal situation. So while you're building it, as I understand, and I'm with Philippe, I voted against this as well, but we've got what we've got. While you're building it, you capitalise the interest and add it on to the asset. But as soon as the asset's finished and you're off and using it, you can't capitalise the interest to it anymore.
Agreed.
Okay, so you're happy you'll expense the interest.
The point here is I'm happy expensing the asset. The question here is whether I use the interest rate on that specific purpose borrowing as part of my determination of my general interest rate for other new assets that come along.
And you'd
and
say
it
no.
It seems to me if I've determined that that funding relates to that asset and I still have that asset and I still have that funding, I'm not sure I have a reason to overturn that.
I mean, it's the weakness in the whole thing, isn't it? Because generally, borrowing's done centrally in big organisations. And so they make up and say, well, but this bit was for that. But then, of course, it just remains in the pool
and
after everything's done.
That is an analysis we do right at the beginning. So right at the beginning, we would decide whether funding is for the purpose of a specific asset or not. Having determined that it is for the purpose of a specific asset, for the purpose of capitalisation, I'm not sure that we have a clear rationale for undoing that the instant the asset is completed. I think if the funding was for the asset and the funding continues and the asset continues, then that determination shouldn't be revisited.
But even if the asset doesn't continue, what difference does that make?
If I've sold the asset, then there is a clear reason that the funding can no longer attach to an asset I no longer have. So it must be part of my general funding pool.
Well, you can make up another asset you're building and attach it to that.
It's a kind of carrying over.
It's contradictory.
I think the problem is the whole thing seems a little contradictory in some ways.
May I respond? There is a very good argument. However, the financing decision might be a little different. If the financing is very good condition, maybe very low interest rate. So headquarter would like keep this financing.
Yeah.
As for the other purpose, then maybe this financing fund might be included in the general.
But I think Cheng Wu, that's almost explains exactly why I'd be uncomfortable with it. So you've got a very low rate because it attaches to that asset.
Yes.
And now you're taking that very low rate, which attached to that asset, and applying it potentially to another asset to which it doesn't actually apply.
Is a remnant of matching?
No. I think it's maybe it is a bit. You don't have the not the determination of the rate anyway.
No.
The fact that you don't have the benefit of the use of the asset is why I think we allow it to be capitalized.
Yes.
and you're not getting any benefits from the asset while it's been constructed.
And we are only talking about capitalization of borrowing costs for other assets which are under construction and qualify for capitalization.
My point here would be that the rate that attaches to the asset that was previously constructed, I don't think is necessarily relevant as a determination of the rate that attaches to new assets that have been constructed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that changes your overall point, which is, do I think that the wording leads me in different directions? Yes, I do.
And I think just on that, the committee also took the view that cash is a fungible asset, and it's very hard to attach it to any particular asset. So whether I have it for a particular asset or not, it's part of the pool that I have available to finance everything.
And I would agree with you, except that the specifics of the circumstances are we have attached that particular block of cash to that asset. We wouldn't be in this problem if we hadn't done that in the first place.
Mm.
So I think we've overridden the fungible and now we're sort of unoverridden it.
Then the committee looked at the amendment and assessed it against the criteria for annual improvement, and that assessment is provided on paragraph 35 on page 10 of the paper. The committee thought that it met the criteria for an annual improvement. So the next question to you, do you agree that it met the criteria for an annual improvement?
An annual clarification.
And the committee looked at the transitional provisions and felt that it should be applied on a prospective basis because the benefits would not outweigh the cost. So do you agree with the committee's analysis that it should be applied on a prospective basis with early application permitted?
All approved.
Okay.
Okay, I'll now turn to papers 12B to 12E. But all these papers are to do with remeasurement of previously held interest in different transactions. The committee originally received a request to address whether previously held interest should be remeasured when an entity that has some interest in a joint operation and is a party to a joint operation obtains joint control over that joint operation. And the committee felt that this problem was probably prevalent in more transactions than just the one that had been submitted. So we analyzed a whole lot of different transactions, and paper 12B basically provides an overview of the approach that the committee took to addressing this project. And when we looked at the different transactions, a summary of which is provided in Appendix A of paper 12B, we identified about 14 transactions for which there was a lack of guidance or lack of clarity on what you should do with previously held or retained interest. And we conducted outreach on all these transactions and looked at the diversity in practice. And based on the feedback that we received and all of the consideration, the committee narrowed down the scope of the project to the following transactions, which were mainly where an entity obtains control over a joint operation. They might have previously been a joint controller or just been a party to the joint operation. The flip side of that, which is where the entity loses control over a group of assets and ends up with an interest that results in them being a joint controller or being a party to the joint operation. And the third transaction was the original submission, which was obtaining joint control in a joint operation. The committee then looked at other transactions where we currently have guidance on what to do with previously held interest to see if they could identify some principles that could guide them in analyzing these transactions. And when they looked through the existing guidance, they noted that the key factors that they should use to drive the analysis would be the significance of the economic event. So for example, IFRS 3 and IFRS 10 characterize obtaining and losing control as significant economic events, and also the measurement model or the basis that is applicable to this retained interest. And they also directed us to see whether the structure of the investment would make a difference, for example, whether it was structured to a separate legal entity or not, and to separately look at transactions involving businesses and non-businesses. So we then took those principles and applied them to the specific transaction, and the remaining paper discussed some of those specific transactions. So I'll now turn over to paper 12C, which discusses a transaction where an entity obtains control over a joint operation that meets the definition of a business. So the committee looked at, analyzed this transaction in light, keeping those principles in mind that we discussed earlier, and they noted that the transaction represented a significant economic event because control had been obtained over a business, and remeasurement would be consistent with the fair value measurement model that's used in IFRS 3. They also looked at the structure of the joint operation and concluded that it should not make a difference, and you should remeasure the previously held interest whether or not you have a separate legal entity. But they also noted that when you look at the wording in IFRS 3, which talks about remeasurement of previously held interest, it explicitly refers to remeasurement of previously held equity interest. And the whole reason for the diversity in practice was that it's not clear as to whether what this term equity interest refers to and whether it applies to interest in a joint operation. And the committee thinks that this should be clarified through an amendment to IFRS 3. So our first question is, does the IFP agree with the analysis and conclusion and that an amendment is needed?
I agree with the conclusions of the analysis. I just make one note that it's very important in this situation to determine whether what you acquire is a business or group of assets. Later today, we are going to discuss a paper which proposes some clarifications or some amendments to defining a business in conjunction with the FASB's own initiatives. So I think that those matters should be maybe looked at together, and maybe a single set of amendments to IFRS 3 should be published at the same time instead of proceeding by successive steps and making people change maybe some practices on the basis of the current definition of a business, whereas at the same time we may be proposing to change the definition of a business. So let's maybe group it together. That will maybe make Chongwu's constituents happier and mine too. So let's try to group all that together.
I think that's a wise suggestion, and I think we can do that.
Mary?
Agree with Philippe's comment, and I think even if we were not doing definition of a business, I'll observe that I have some question about whether this is appropriate as an AIP, which is what the paper says. Because even if it's relatively few words that have to change, I think this is conceptually quite a significant issue, and it seems that there's pretty widespread diversity in practice for transactions that are significant to the entities involved. So just a heads up in terms of thinking about the scope of AIPs generally, but I think it's a moot point because of the suggestion that Philippe makes. I think it would be very good to package it with anything that might come out of a definition of a business. But it also, and I'll just kind of give comments that also apply to the papers not teed up because it all kind of comes together. It seems that the interpretation committee, partly by focusing on the principle of the significance of the economic event, has reached an overall conclusion that the only event that is sufficiently significant to trigger remeasurement of the previously held interest is crossing the control boundary. So it's not going to significant influence, it's not going to joint control, it's only that. And I think the words are unclear because of the general instruction to look to many of the consolidation procedures, and you don't know if it includes that remeasurement or not. But if that's the overall conclusion, I think it would be good to express it that way because I think it brings a lot more clarity. I think the interpretation committee did have to grind through all the details. I think that was good and healthy in the right discipline, in terms of looking for words that are inconsistent, et cetera. But when you step back, I think I communicate about this by saying they've decided that this instruction to remeasure retained interest is unique to the situation of gaining control. Therefore, it doesn't apply in other situations, in which you're applying BizCom accounting by analogy, and where you're cross-directed to it. And I think one thing that when it comes back to us for overview, I think it would be helpful for the interpretation committee to be informed and for us to be informed whether this issue has been looked at under U.S. GAAP, given that the BizCom standard was a joint standard, in this question of control, gaining or losing control being the trigger for remeasurement of retained interest. I don't know, I don't think it would be determinative, but I just think I'd like to be informed about that, before we finalize, and where if it's as crisp a decision as it's control and it's only control and crossing the control barrier, that makes me a lot more comfortable when we get to, I think it's paper E, that says then go ahead and do the loss of control as well, because because the theme seems to be throughout these papers that IFRS 3 says that the requirement to remeasure retained interest for crossing the control threshold supersedes any incompatibility in other standards.
Yeah, the same point as Mary. Just to question to the staff to confirm or not this view, because this was my reading of paragraphs 16 and 17. Because exactly they are focused on control, acquisition of control. So is that so? Apparently, yes.
Yes, it is. So it is that crossing of the control boundary is the trigger.
This and the only trigger.
Yes, well, it's
triggered from a transaction point of
view. Yeah, there is not any other here highlighted, at least. So your concern is clear, in my view, clear.
If you become a financial asset investment under IFRS 9, you would have fair value, but that's not triggered by the transaction as such. It's triggered by the IFRS 9 accounting.
Yeah, so would be clear and make her comfortable in that aspect.
Any other comments?
Yes. So, our first question again, do you agree with the amendment? And our second question is, when the committee looked at the criteria, they agreed it should be an annual improvement. So, do you agree it should be an annual improvement or should we wait for three after 3 years?
Well, I think I'd propose that we don't suggest an annual
improvement.
We change it to
correct.
Put it in with the definition of business.
Okay. Yeah.
We should ask for a vote on that basis.
Correct. So, should we put it with the definition of a business? Then?
Narrow scope.
Yeah. All agreed.
I'll agree.
Michael, just to confirm, these aspects that are highlighted in 16 and 17 about control, this will be at some place with the basis or clarification here, right? Because I was in the appendix reading, but although I'm aware that the appendix is not definite yet, so just to make clear that this is important, please.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yes. Question 3.
And our question 3 is on to be applied on a prospective basis with early application permitted.
Okay. Might that depend partly on what we do on the business definition?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So we'll circle back on that later, maybe, just to check.
Yeah.
Okay,
excellent.
You've been a very busy man.
Yes. Okay, now turn your attention to paper 12E, which discusses the transaction where joint control is obtained, where the entity previously had some interest in the joint operation and was a party to the joint operation. And again, in this case, the joint operation meets the definition of a business. And the committee analyzed this transaction using the same principle that we had discussed earlier. They thought the transaction was more analogous to a transaction where an investment in an associate becomes an investment in a joint venture. And IAS 28 discusses this transaction and says previously held interest should not be remeasured, so the transaction is not significant enough to trigger the remeasurement requirement. So on that basis, the committee concluded that this transaction does not represent a significant economic event that would trigger the remeasurement requirement. And they also concluded that not remeasuring would be consistent with the IFRS 11 requirements, which require an entity to account for assets and liabilities in accordance with those respective standards that apply. They also thought that the structure would not affect their conclusion. But they also noted that the wording in IFRS 11 could be read as implying that previously held interest should be remeasured or can be remeasured in some instances. So they have proposed an amendment to IFRS 11 again, and they think it meets the criteria for an annual improvement. So our first two questions to you, do you agree with the committee's analysis and conclusion, and do you agree that it's an annual improvement? Any comments?
The annual improvement point is the one we just discussed. Yeah. It applies throughout all of these.
Because this amendment is to IFRS 11 and does not contain a business, would you be in favor of grouping it with the business definition or keeping it group of, okay, Phil.
I'll jump in and say I would, because it's the same issue.
Correct.
And I think you can just, as I said, I think you can just say there's an overarching conclusion that comes out of the consideration of all three of these issues. It's X, and therefore there are the following amendments.
I agree too. I think people will have a clearer understanding if they see all the different aspects of what we are discussing and the impact on different amendments. In a way, it is some form of consequential amendments of defining a business.
Yeah. Okay, with that clarification or amendment, do we agree with that recommendation?
All agreed.
Excellent. And the amendment should be applied on a prospective basis with...
No, that's
what we'll defer it. Yeah, we'll defer that discussion again. Yeah. Perfect. So I now turn to paper 12E. We discussed the loss of control transaction. So this is a transaction where an entity loses control over an asset or a group of assets, and the remaining interest results in the entity having either joint control in the joint operation or being a party to a joint operation. And the group of assets may or may not constitute a business. So when the committee looked at this, they noted that loss of control is a significant economic event. And when the group of assets meets the definition of a business, a number of committee members expressed a preference for remeasurement of the previously held interest. But they also observed that the paragraph B34 and B35 of IFRS 11 talk about downstream transactions and sale of assets to a joint operation. And they say that you can only recognize gains and losses to the extent of the other party's interest. So they noted there's a conflict with IFRS 10, but this conflict is similar to the conflict that exists in IS 28 versus IFRS 10, and this was subject to recent amendments by the board, and which would result in the retained interest being measured differently, depending on whether or not it was a business, and what the nature of the retained investment was. So when the committee looked at this, they felt they could reach a conclusion, at least in the case where the group of transactions involves a business, but they would like to consult with the IFB to think if they should continue their discussion or if they should defer their discussion. So we would like to obtain your views and feedback on that, and that's really what the questions pertain to, whether you think they should continue or defer their discussions, and if you have any other advice for the committee.
What's their proposal? Is there a proposal?
They don't have the idea.
No, they haven't proposed anything to stop their discussions, noting that it was quite similar to the transaction that was subject to the amendment, so they haven't really reached any conclusion, and we haven't taken any vote of the committee members on any of the issues.
I don't feel that it is an urgent matter, because I don't see many situations where you are in a joint control situation and you lose control but you retain an interest. I think it's not very frequent. I think there are some implications in comparison to the other standard we have proposed to amend and then we decided to postpone. Then to take a position on this matter, well, at the same time, we are not quite sure where we are going with your situation of when you have equity interest. So I feel we should wait a little bit and see how things evolve.
I think Philippe's caution is good advice, but if there is a single conceptual conclusion that it's control and only control, then I think we're maybe looking more at the kind of analogy to the discussion I think you had in captured in this paper that said there are other instances in which the requirement to remeasure retained interest when you lose control is in conflict with other measurement literature, but IFRS 3 is explicit that the remeasurement requirement overrides. I mean, I don't want to push the interpretation committee to going ahead if they really see strong analogies to the issue that's causing us more difficulty on a mechanical basis with the upstream, downstream, et cetera. But if they think that there's a conceptual package, I wouldn't be opposed to them bringing forward that as part of the package. I mean, this is something we've asked them to develop, even if we incorporate it into, you know, package it with the anything that comes out of definition of a business. So I still would like to have their views. I'm glad they noted the overlap and paused to check on that. But I think I'd turn to them and say, what do you think we should do?
Uh,
Okay. Any other comments?
Okay. Does the staff agree with that? Because I just worry about what a sort of difficult situation we've got into with the IAS 28 amendments. Do we think we're wise to ask the committee to push ahead, given what's happened with the other amendments that we decided to, I don't know, defer or whatever it was, and all of those other difficulties that we've got? Because I'm always loath to ask them to do something that ultimately we've got a problem with. So I hear what Mary's saying, but it's very different to what Philippe was saying. Just to know what the current thinking is on 28.
Good words of caution. I think what I'm hearing from you know a few of you here is when we take this back, and obviously we'll report this conversation back to the interpretation committee, as part of that we should be looking to see, is the crossing of the control threshold a sufficiently clear transaction that can be distinguished from these other ones that we've proposed to postpone, or is it just too closely related that actually it'd be better to pause and wait until we've concluded what we want to do on the equity accounting first before going ahead.
Makes sense.
So I think that's the message that I would take back from your discussion today. So, caution.
Personally, I'm not sure that there is such a big difference between control and joint control to trigger a remeasurement of the retained interest. To me, joint control is somewhere just between control and equity accounting, but it's maybe not sufficiently different from control to really trigger that remeasurement. And I know the conceptual framework doesn't discuss at all remeasurement of assets when you have this kind of transaction. So we don't have a conceptual basis, I'm afraid, and maybe Peter can comment, we don't have a conceptual basis to decide in which direction we should be going here. And if I take a very old-fashioned approach to what is realized profit, I'm not sure there is any realized profit in this situation, but I think that's very old-fashioned, this kind of dinosaur approach, I can't think.
But I think further to what Mary's been saying, I thought that the committee had sort of got to a position where they thought control was a big deal relative to anything else, whether that's joint control, significant influence, or something lesser. And if that is the logic, then I think it's a different position to what Philippe just expressed. I mean, obviously we'll need people's feedback on that, but I think that was sort of the core idea that's the thread through all of this analysis.
Yeah, they have concluded that control is the significant barrier, and when they looked at the other transaction in 12D, which was obtaining joint control, they thought that was not a significant economic event, and that was driven more from what's already in IAS 28, which says that obtaining joint control and moving from significant influence to joint control is not a significant economic event. So
but anything going to control is?
Anything, correct. Anything crossing the line of control is the significant economic event.
But joint control just doesn't seem like it works all that well in practice. I mean, you control something, but if you have to have a deal, you have a 50-50 position, I mean, you don't have unilateral ability to do anything you want either, so that sort of a very weak form of control at best.
And one of the arguments that I saw in the papers, but maybe encourage the interpretation committee to think about and capture, is the link with the definition of the group, which is, so it isn't just the interpretation committee's opinion that it's control and only control, it's a significant event, but they were pointing to the change in the composition of the group as only occurring with control, and the fact that I4S conceptually, I think in 10 rather than in the conceptual framework, says that the definition of a group excludes jointly controlled entities. So I think that link to the definition of a group was an important conceptual basis supporting the singling out of crossing the control threshold.
You?
I was just going to make a broader point in relation to IS 28. There were a lot of different moving parts and a lot of different amendments being proposed. I think they'll come back to them in November, Michael, is that right? Certainly in relation to the amendments where there's a we're proposing an indefinite deferral. And I think the board's going to have to give some really hard thought to this, because we've heard from some countries, principally Australia and New Zealand, that there are legal consequences of indefinite deferral, which cause a lot of awkwardness. So I think there's a very careful and thorough discussion needed on these IS 28 amendments so that we land in a good place.
Can I maybe add to that as well, sort of update on the research project on the equity method, because the board had agreed that we would do some sort of short-term simplifications, I guess is the best description for it, and then some longer-term research about what the method is for and why it's been used and all that kind of thing. And we discussed that with ASAF in September. There was a fair amount of scepticism around the ASAF table about trying to do that sort of exercise. So the project team are regrouping and sort of digesting the input we got from ASAF. And I think it's likely we're not going to bring anything back to the board until we've got the results of the agenda consultation. So the short-term project is probably not going to be very short-term.
But I think the important point on this is it's very hard to make targeted amendments when you don't know what the long-term fundamental direction is.
And obviously the tricky balance is if there actually are urgent issues that people don't know what the answers are, we can't sort of wait forever either.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. That's